Hello and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding areas. This is the Saturn edition for the week ending Saturday, 13th of February, 2021. My name is Ian. I normally edit and produce the primary programme, but today I'm standing in for Alex, who is unwell. This edition of Saturn will again be distributed on USB sticks. Please remember to return them in the wallet provided when you have finished listening. Additionally, the programme is available on our website, sadtn.org.uk, under Listen Online. If you are using a mobile device, it's available via the British Wireless for the Blind Fund app. This edition also sees the return, on the USB stick distribution only, of the BBC In Touch podcast. We'll have the usual news roundup and the national radio listings read by John Cushing. I'm also going to play an item from the Talking News Federation, an organisation which publishes material of interest to the visually impaired. This week's music is A Brighter Heart by Gothby. Let's move on to the news read by Kalpana, Peter, Alison and Claire.
Hello, this is Kalpana Block. And my first article is about the wildlife in our area, and it's titled Protected Wildlife Site Polluted by Diesel Dumping. Ponds, which provide breeding ground for protected species and other rare wildlife, have been poisoned with dumped diesel. Smallford Pits has been designated as a local wildlife site, which identifies it as a crucial location for wildlife in the county and protects it from development by the planning system. The site has also been identified as a breeding ground for great crested newts, a European protected species, and is also an important area in Herts for dragonflies. Smallford Pits supports 19 species of dragonfly, including the nationally rare scarce emerald dragonfly. Only Kingsmead, near Hertford, supports as many dragonfly species in the county. The area is also rich in birds and reptiles. Last September, the ponds on the site were completely dug out and scrub cut to the ground. Then in December, the ponds were polluted with either petrol or diesel, which had been dumped into the water. The Police and Environment Agency are currently investigating the pollution as a wildlife crime. Christine Pedder, who first reported the pollution, said, "I have enjoyed the ponds for many years and love seeing the amazing wildlife in and around them. My main concern is that this crime will not be prosecuted and as a result will set a precedent." Matt Dodds, Planning and Biodiversity Manager at Herts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust, said, "It's devastating news that one of our most significant wildlife-rich sites has been subjected to these actions, which has destroyed the habitats of the species that depend on it. We are living in a biodiversity emergency, and we cannot afford to lose vital wild places like Smallford Pits that are home to such diversity of life." Herts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust was made aware of the ongoing issue last year by local residents who reported the pond destruction and have since been trying to resolve the issue with the help of the community and the police. The Trust was appalled to discover that the damage has escalated over the past few weeks by chemicals in what remains of the ponds, thought to be diesel or petrol, effectively poisoning the wildlife there. A spokesperson for the Environment Agency said, "Following reports of suspected pollution, we sent an officer to inspect two ponds at Smallford Pits. These lie within a site of special scientific interest, or designated an SSSI site, designated by Natural England. Our officer found minimal traces of oil in each pond, which were degrading naturally, so no need to clearing up was required. There was no evidence to identify from where the oil had come. Neighbours and visitors to Smallford Pits have reacted to the wanton pollution of the wildlife site." County Councillor for Coney Heath and Marshallswick, John Hale, responded to the vandalism. He said, "I'm very angry at what appears to have been the deliberate destruction of a wildlife site at a time when we are all being encouraged to protect such sites. We need to be encouraging wildlife, not destroying it. I hope that the recent commitments by both the county and district councils to increase biodiversity will mean that improvements elsewhere will mitigate somewhat the damage done here. But it's a disgrace that this site has been damaged. Local resident Steve Brooks works for the Department of Life Sciences at the Natural History Museum. Over 2020, he surveyed the dragonflies at the site and identified 19 different species, of which at least 16 were breeding. Steve said, "It's so sad to see this wonderful wildlife site so badly damaged. It's the last thing we need at a time of biodiversity crisis. Places like this are so unusual in Hertfordshire, a truly wild site managed by a herd of ponies, a bit like a mini New Forest on the edge of St Albans. Smallford Pitts has more species of dragonflies than any other in the county, including nationally rare species. It is also rich in aquatic plants and birds, so we cannot afford to lose this site." If a member of the public is concerned about a suspected environmental incident, they should phone the Environment Agency free on the 24-hour incident hotline on 0800 80 70 60.
Hello, this is Peter Block. And my first article has the headline, "Vaccination Team Delivers Drive-Through Service Despite Heavy Snow." The vaccination team at Batchwood Hall has overcome the snow by offering a drive-through service this week. To date, the campaign at the Old Club Batchwood has delivered more than 10,000 vaccinations, protecting some of the most vulnerable members of the community. 8 GP practices across St Albans and surrounding areas have come together to work at scale and have taken over the former nightclub, transforming it into a site offering vaccinations on a mass scale up to 2,000 people a day. Dr. Helen McAndrew, joint clinical lead at Batchwood, said, "The only thing stopping us now is the limited vaccine supply, which has meant we have only been able to offer 2 sessions per week. We are used to delivering vaccination campaigns year in, year out, and by pooling our experience and knowledge, we have developed a safe vaccine offer for our local community." Batchwood's and other vaccination centres' supply issues were highlighted by St Albans MP Daisy Cooper, who took her concerns to the Prime Minister's Question Time last month. She asked Boris Johnson if he would personally intervene to ensure Batchwood Hall and other primary care network-led vaccine units greater and more consistent vaccine supply. "Some of this group of patients have not left their homes for almost a year," confirmed joint clinical lead Dr. Mike Walton. "Being able to vaccinate them from the safety of their own vehicles has been met with some very emotional responses. The experience has been moving for the whole team involved. Just imagine what we could achieve if we had even more vaccine supply." Despite the below-freezing blizzard conditions that graced St Albans at the start of this week, the Batchwood team set about welcoming and vaccinating patients in the practice by virtual consultation and now the nightclub car park. Joint clinical lead Dr. Bruce Covell said, "The way the whole of the general practice has adapted and evolved since the start of the pandemic has been truly remarkable. Batchwood Hall has been offering vaccinations to all patients aged over 70 and is now in the position to start inviting patients aged 65 to 69. This piece is accompanied by a picture of the car park of Batchwood Hall with tents and staff standing by and clearly marked up with zones so that people can drive their vehicles in and have the vaccination.
Hello, this is Alison. My first story has the headline, "Tributes Pour In for Well-Loved Ice Cream Man." Tributes have been paid to Giuseppe Joe Giubba, known by many in St Albans as Joe the Ice Cream Man. Joe, who passed away on Saturday, January the 9th, at the age of 57, lived and worked in St Albans all of his life. Joe was born in the city and had lived in Brampton Road until his family moved to Marshallswick when he was around 16 years old. Joe met his wife Tracy in 1982 and they later married in 1987. They had 4 children, Connie, Vittorio, Alessandra and Gianmarco, and in the last 3 years he became granddad to his two beautiful granddaughters who he cherished. His career began in 1978 when he took up an apprenticeship within the motor trade. He later qualified as a motor technician and continued to work within the industry until 1989. His late father, Vittorio, had been an ice cream man around St Albans and Hemel for about 8 years prior to his death in 1984. It was then that Joe decided to follow in his father's footsteps. He wanted to continue as his father had done, and so built himself his own round, which covered mainly St Albans and London Colney. Joe was dedicated to his job and made many friends along the way. Everyone that got to know him loved him for his kindness, strength and humour. He was a well-known face at many charity events, including the annual open days at St Albans Fire Station and Harvesters Football Club. A statement from St Albans Fire Station said, "The station was always grateful that Joe attended our open days and other organised events, and he helped support various charities over the years. He always had a queue of people waiting for an ice cream too. Joe liked to occasionally call in at the station on a hot summer's day on his way home, which was always welcomed by the duty crews. Joe was a delight to talk to with a big warm smile. Joe will be missed, and we offer our sincere condolences to his family and friends at this difficult time." Graham Roberts, who used to organise football tournaments and other events for Harvesters Football Club, paid tribute. "Joe was simply one of the kindest men you could hope to meet, and I was privileged to call him my friend. He would do anything for you and was a huge favourite with the kids at all the events he supported, with his happy disposition and genuine compassion. His kindness just shone through and he will be sorely missed in and around St Albans. I could always rely on him being at my events, whatever the weather, no matter how good or bad he was feeling that day. He would never let you down. He would always stay until the last child had got their ice cream and would never abandon his post. Many times we would be the last two people to leave the event, and if I didn't have my car with me, he would insist I jump in the back of the ice cream van and he would drop me home, right to my door. Nothing was ever too much trouble for Joe. We think they are small things, but actually it's all the very many small things that hold friendships and communities together. Before the pandemic, when I walked to work, Joe would often pass me on his travels. He would always give me a toot on his horn or stop for a chat. I will miss that. I will miss Joe. We all will." The funeral will take place on Monday, February the 15th at 10 a.m. at St Albans and St Stephen Church, followed by a burial at London Road Cemetery. Unfortunately, due to the current circumstances, only immediate family will be able to attend, but it will be live streamed at www.albanstephen.org. There will be a farewell journey for Joe, with details set to be revealed on social media. The family asks mourners to consider current restrictions on social distancing, and a donation page has been set up in Joe's memory at www.dignityfunerals.co.uk/funeral-notices/9/01/2021 Giuseppe Jubba.
Hello, this is Claire reading. My first article is about how a community rallied together to stop an elderly Park Street residence house from flooding. On January 30th, Watford-based Samuel Leach was walking around the lakes in the southern part of St Albans district when he came across a cottage that was threatened by fast-rising flood water. Samuel, who is a trader and Instagram personality with a whopping 360,000 followers, made a plea to his fans for manpower and sandbags to help protect the Park Street home. Knocking on the cottage door to ensure everything was okay, Samuel met Eileen, a woman in her 80s. Exclaiming that the water hadn't risen this high since the 1990s, she feared there was nothing she could do to stop the water reaching her front door. Eileen told Samuel that her son, who usually helped her out when water threatened her home, had recently passed away after contracting COVID in hospital, so she now had no one to help bail out the water. Realising this was a job for more than one person, Samuel took to his Instagram stories, asking local tradesmen and volunteers to do what they could to help Eileen. "I'll be honest, I was a bit worried that no one would reply to start with," Samuel told the Hearts ad. "If I was giving something away, hundreds of people would be like, me, me, me. But when you're asking people to give up your Saturday, put on some wellies and stand outside in the rain to put your hands into cold water to put sandbags down, you wouldn't expect much of a reply. People were saying they'd be there in 5 minutes. How can you be here in 5 minutes? And they were just turning up in trainers and jeans and saying they didn't have time to turn back and get their wellies. They were getting fully into knee-deep water in jeans and trainers to help out. It was amazing. One of those volunteers was Gavin McKay from Tring, whose work for Chevron Traffic Management meant he had access to more than enough sandbags to save Eileen's home. Two trips to Tring, totaling over 2 hours, and 200 sandbags later, and thanks to a loaned water pump and the assistance of St Albans Fire Brigade, the gaggle of volunteers managed to build a defence around the semi-detached cottage, protecting it from the once waist-high water after 5 hours of hard graft. Making light of the situation and joking, "Who needs the gym when you're lifting 20 kilograms of sodden bags of sand?" Samuel praised everyone that came to Eileen's aid, stating that many hands made light work. Gavin's honestly an absolute hero. He's just a lovely, lovely guy, and we wouldn't have been able to do it without him. Gavin said, "It was just a small drop in the ocean, really. Sam is the hero, really. Most people walk past these things nowadays, and he took the time out of his day. He organised for this lady to be saved from the flood. I just happened to be there." He added, "Sam was amazing that day. No word of a lie. He had his wellies on, rain mac and all that. He was in the thick of it. He stopped and spent the time organising for her house to be saved. Speaking to Eileen on the day, I was so touched by her." The volunteers also took time to make sure Eileen was well looked after even once the teams left, with the fire brigade checking her smoke alarms and also registering her to a charity that ensured she received one hot meal a day. Samuel's partner, Nicola McDonald, got Park Street Residents Association on board to provide Eileen with fresh food every week, and handymen are now at her disposal to help with odd jobs around the house. Samuel will clear the sandbags with the help of the local fire service when the coast is clear, and will store as many of them as he can in his back garden so they're at the community's disposal the next time flood water rises. And the article is accompanied by a photo of the team all in their wellies and coats and masks.
New St Albans Chief Inspector hails the dedication of the policing team. St Albans has a new Chief Inspector heading the district's policing teams. Chief Inspector Mike Todd takes over from Chief Inspector Linda Coates after acting as Hearts Police's Silver Commander for Operation Bullrush, the planning and tactical delivery of Hertfordshire's operational policing response to the COVID-19 pandemic. As the St Albans District Chief Inspector, he leads approximately 150 officers and staff. He said, "I'm delighted to take on this role in St Albans. I will continue to build upon the excellent work to date, with a greater shift from reactive to proactive policing. I will work collaboratively with our community and partners to prevent harm, prevent crime, and prevent reoffending, ensuring that St Albans District remains a safe place to live, work, and visit. I'm already incredibly impressed with the dedication of officers and staff who work across St Albans, Harpenden and London Colney." Chief Inspector Todd brings with him almost three decades of policing experience in varied roles across the county, predominantly in frontline operational roles. Chief Inspector Coates, who was in post for 2.5 years, said, "I'm sad to be leaving St Albans. I've thoroughly enjoyed working here. I cannot fault the dedication of officers who have worked under very difficult circumstances during the pandemic, putting their own lives at risk to help others. We've built up a fantastic relationship with our partners to deal with short and longer term issues across the district, and I am especially pleased that after a long investigation, we were able to get people arrested and charged for the series of violent crime in Clarence Park and London Colney." On taking up his new post, Chief Inspector Todd said, "I'm really keen to work in partnership with our community. One of the ways you can help reduce crime is to act upon the crime prevention advice. In our own OWL, that stands for Online Watch Link, email messages. Simply log on to owl.co.uk/hearts to join in and find out more. We also have Facebook and Twitter accounts in St Albans with daily messages about what we're doing. Please follow us at St Albans Police.
My next article has the headline, Have Your Say on Plans to Revamp St Albans Market. Stalls at St Albans Historic Charter Market could be replaced with gazebos as part of a major revamp. Artists' impressions on how the market could change have now been released as part of a public consultation. Traders, shops on St Peter's Street, residents and other local businesses and organisations are being urged to have their say. The District Council, which runs the market, says the scheme will give the market a modern, dynamic appearance, help with its post-COVID recovery and avoid the need for the diesel-powered mini tractors used to transport the old stalls. During the pandemic, traders have been erecting their own gazebos to make the market more COVID secure, but these are in a mix of colours and lack the blue and yellow conformity of the old stalls. Councillor Mandy McNeil, portfolio holder for Business, Tourism and Culture, said, Our plans for the charter market are intended to give it a new lease of life when it is fully operational again and also improve the city centre environment. This will help our business recover from the pandemic when COVID restrictions eventually ease. Modernising the market by providing attractive gazebos in matching colours will greatly enhance the look and atmosphere of St Peter Street on market days. We're now talking with a range of stakeholders about these ambitious plans. Most importantly, we want to get the traders on board as they are what the market is all about. We want to ensure we have their support for our proposals, as well as the city's retail sector, shoppers, residents and visitors. I urge everyone to take part in the consultation and give their views. The market hasn't undergone a major facelift like this for many, many years, and we believe our plans will be a major improvement. Give your views on the changes here. www.surveymonkey.co.uk/r/charter-market-survey. That's also all one word. Traders are also being consulted about the new policies intended to make the operation of the market fairer and more transparent. And this article is also accompanied by a picture, an artist's impression of how the charter market might look in the future.
The next story has the title, St Albans Man Creates Acclaimed Interactive Computer Game. A St Albans man has realised his dream, making and publishing a highly acclaimed interactive Android game. Michael Nisbet, 42, who lives in Jersey Farm, works for a national pharmaceutical organisation by day. But he spent the last 5 years spending his free time creating Black Lazar. It features many talents, including more than 120 hand-drawn works of art, a mystery story of 250,000 words across 15 chapters, and over an hour of original music. He had the idea about 7 years ago, but only started work 2 years later. His original vision was more basic for a smaller project than it became. It took so long because it has branching storylines with differing events and outcomes dependent on what the player does as they go along. This involved a tricky writing process, coming up with alternative narratives, and is what helps make the game unique and enticing. For example, choices the player makes early on in the game impact on the game throughout, such as navigating through a forest with a companion, which can be one of four characters. So that was time-consuming and complex to write. Michael said, I worked hard on it all. Not that it was technically work, as I enjoyed it, which was key. I've always liked writing sci-fi and horror, but what I actually enjoyed was creating worlds, places inhabited with interesting characters and situations. In making the app, I was combining multiple media to create a story you could influence. I ended up with artwork for every single page and adaptive music throughout, as well as sound effects. I worked on it over weekends and evenings, pretty much all of my free time, consistently building it into my routine around work and studying for an actuary qualification. I never felt like it was work as I enjoyed the whole process, and if I banged my head against the wall over the writing, I could switch to the music or the art and vice versa. He drew 150 images with charcoal sketches, improving them with digital software, used his phone to do sound effects, even crushing an onion to create the sound of a head being crushed. It's not for children, strictly adults only. The pandemic made no difference to his routine, and he spent his regained commute time on his day job anyway, so he can even thank COVID-19 for helping him complete his goal. Michael is passionate about what kept him busy for the past 5 years. He said, "The central idea behind the story is the rivalry between a detective working for Interpol and the crime lord, the Black Lazar, with global influence, who has, until recently, operated entirely unbeknownst to the world's intelligence and police agencies. When a mutual tragedy, experienced in flashback, affects the two men, things accelerate to a confrontation that will change their and the player's understanding of everything that has occurred to that point. And there's a twist at the end. Naturally, everybody likes a good twist." Black Lazar is self-published under the name of Pleon Words, P-L-E-O-N, Words. It has received multiple five-star reviews by players who described it as fantastic, interesting, and intriguing. Currently, the game is only available on Android, but Michael is halfway through making a version which is compatible with Apple devices and PCs. It's available to download free on Google Play.
My next story is about a safer route for cyclists between the villages of Wheathampstead and Sandridge, which will be completed this spring. The 600-metre path across No Man's Land Common will offer cyclists an alternative to using the busy B651 and enable better year-round non-motorised transport. The Common has experienced much greater footfall during the pandemic, when fresh air and exercise have been more important than ever. No Man's Land is a haven for wildlife, with locally rare examples of remnant heath alongside wooded areas and meadows which provide an abundance of wildflowers. Loosely surfaced paths protect valuable grassland, as people naturally use the path instead of trampling large areas in wet conditions. The County Council is leading the project, supported by St Albans District Council and representatives of Sandridge and Wheathampstead Parish Councils. Phil Bibby, County Cabinet Member for Highways and Environment, said, "I am delighted that this project has now gained planning approval and look forward to the installation happening this spring. COVID-19 has shown us all how active travel is so important for physical and mental well-being, and I envisage it will be very well used." Wheathampstead and Sandridge County Councillor Annie Brewster added, "The B651 is one of the most dangerous roads in our district, having seen many fatalities on bicycles or on foot. Only very experienced cyclists dare venture onto this narrow, winding national speed limit road. It has long been the desire to have an off-road connecting dual-use cycle and pedestrian path. The plan is to run the new path adjacent to the roadside ditch, so it will not interrupt the open views across No Man's Land Common. I would like to thank everyone involved, including Wheathampstead and Sandridge Village residents, for their support for this much sought-after path that will create a wonderful connective commuting and leisure corridor. Work on the route should commence at the end of March and be completed by the end of April of this year. The provision of cycling links is a key part of the County Council's Local Transport Plan 4, which aims to ensure that walking or cycling are natural choices for local journeys in the future." And there's a photo that shows Councillor Annie Brewster at the entrance to Wheathampstead in front of the sign.
Revealed: tourism's monumental contribution to the county's economy. Nearly £140 million was spent in the local economy in Harts each month in 2019 as a direct result of the county's tourism and hospitality industry, a new report has revealed. Visit Harts' latest Tourism Economic Impact Study, published this week, shows that before the devastating impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, the county's visitor economy had topped £2.4 billion for the first time ever. Using the industry-respected Cambridge Economic Impact Model, the study measured the volume and value of tourism across the county in 2019, and the impact of visits and visitor expenditure on the Harts economy. Deirdre Wells, OBE, Chief Executive of Visit Harts, said, The insights presented as part of this latest research demonstrate the monumental contribution our industry makes to the overall Hertfordshire economy. Our visitor economy businesses sit at the very heart of the vibrant destinations throughout our region, attracting skilled workers and businesses looking to relocate, as well as providing key infrastructure to support the operations of businesses across a range of diverse industries. A total of £139 million was spent on average in the local economy each month in 2019, and the county welcomed a record 29 million visitors. Of this total, 27.1 million people were day trips. St Albans had nearly 2.2 million trips, both day and overnight stays, with a total visitor spend of more than £150 million. While Welwyn Garden City had 2 million visitors, North Harts 3 million visitors, and Stevenage 1.9 million visitors. Hartsmere had 1.5 million visitors. The independent research commissioned by Hertfordshire's official destination management organisation also showed an 8% increase between 2017 and 2019 in the number of tourism jobs across the county, rising to 43,390, which accounts for 7% of the total employment in Hertfordshire that year. The release of Hart's latest economic impact findings not only provides a detailed picture of the significant value and importance of the county's tourism and hospitality sector had on the region's wider economy in 2019, it also establishes a benchmark from which to measure the impact of COVID-19. Deirdre Wells said, "In light of the current COVID-19 pandemic, the tourism, leisure and hospitality sector is having to drastically rethink how to rebuild demand and revenue streams, working together to adapt, develop and survive. We are proud to be working closely with our partners at Hertfordshire Local Enterprise Partnership and the Hearts Growth Hub on a programme of activity that aims to support the recovery of our industry following the ongoing effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. Continued collaboration will be critical in championing the recovery of our sector during a particularly challenging year ahead." This latest research shows that the value of Hearts tourism and hospitality industry was on a positive trajectory in 2019, and the county performed better overall than the wider East of England region. Launched in May 2020, Hearts Local Enterprise Partnership and Visit Hearts are currently working in partnership to offer small and micro businesses within the tourism, leisure, hospitality, retail, arts and cultural sectors the chance to unlock between £2,000 and £5,000 in match funding to help overcome the challenges of COVID-19. The £200,000 Crowdfund Hertfordshire Small Businesses Innovation Fund is currently being administered by Visit Hearts and is delivered through the Crowdfunder Pay It Forward platform. Nitin Dahart, Chair of Hearts Local Enterprise Partnerships and Innovation Board, said, "These figures demonstrate the continued growth of the sector prior to the pandemic and just how important the visitor economy is to Hertfordshire's recovery. Thanks to the strength of Visit Hearts partnership, we were quickly able to mobilise funding streams to support those small and micro businesses most in need and provide valuable and trusted support to these key sectors throughout the crisis. This collaboration will be vital as we rebuild Hertfordshire's economy and positively adapt to the changing patterns of living and working post-pandemic." If you'd like some more information about Hertfordshire tourism, then I'd suggest you visit the website, which is www.visitharts.co.uk.
This piece has the headline, "How Visit Hearts is Helping to Raise County's Profile." Visit Hearts works with a range of public and private sector businesses and organisations to raise the county's profile as a leading destination. Activities include targeting UK and overseas markets through consumer marketing and PR campaigns, forging strong relationships with the travel trade, improving quality and skills with the industry, and growing investment in tourism. The new Visit Hearts report is an extremely useful vehicle in aiding the recovery of the tourism sector after lockdown has ended. One of Hearts' biggest tourist draws is Warner Brothers Studio Tour London, The Making of Harry Potter at Leavesden. Referring to the study's findings, Senior Vice President and General Manager Jeff Spooner, Visit Hearts co-chair, said, "These figures underline the economic value to Hertfordshire of its world-class tourism offering, with 2019 being a particularly stellar year. The breadth of Hertfordshire's tourism offer positions the region to bounce back strongly and quickly from the challenges of 2020, when the opportunity to rebuild the sector arrives. Visit Hearts' network of existing public and private partnerships, together with successful placemaking development since its launch in 2015, allowing the county's destination management organisation to respond quickly in the face of the current pandemic, collaborating closely with partners on a programme of activity that aims to aid the county's recovery from the coronavirus pandemic. The recovery of Hertfordshire's visitor economy will be further supported by funding recently secured by Visit Hearts as part of Visit England's Escape the Everyday Destination Management Organisation's Marketing Recovery Fund. Escape the Everyday will provide an opportunity for Visit Hearts to deliver local marketing activity focusing on Hearts' fantastic local produce and outdoor experiences, which aligns closely to the UK-wide domestic tourism campaign. The campaign aims to support the industry to recover by encouraging consumers to explore, discover, and treat themselves to a short break when COVID-19 related restrictions allow and when they are ready to travel.
The next story is about clowning around. Fancy clowning around? A St Albans theatre company is launching an online workshop designed to leave you smiling. Trestle Theatre Company's School of Drama is running an online workshop this February half term, devised with only one thing in mind: to make you laugh. Clowning Around will take place on Wednesday, February the 17th, with three sessions tailored to suit different age groups. Clowning Around Little Laughs will run from 9 a.m. to 10:30 a.m. and is for ages 4 to 7 years. Organisers say, join us for 90 minutes of laughter and mayhem, creating your own hilarious clown character. Come dressed in your silliest outfit as we work together to explore what it means to be a clown through drama games and activities. Trestle Theatre Company, which is based at Trestle Arts Based in Russet Drive, will then be running Clowning Around, Clowning 101, from 11 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. This session is for ages 8 to 10. Creatives this time are asking, are you the funniest family member? Are you always the first to crack a joke? If the answer is yes, join Trestle as they release your inner clown through drama games and activities in just 90 minutes. Costumes welcome. Clowning Around, the Art of Clowning, will then take place from 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. This online session is especially for ages 11 to 14 years. Here, participants will take a deeper look into what it means to be a clown and develop new skills. Youngsters will also find their inner clown through physical exploration, drama games, and activities. All sessions will take place via Zoom on Wednesday, February the 17th. The workshops cost £6 per child per session and can be booked online at www.trestle.org.uk. Based in St Albans, Trestle Arts Base is a 100-year-old chapel beautifully converted into a unique performing arts centre. It's also home to Trestle, one of the country's longest-standing and most innovative theatre companies. For all the latest information about what's on at Trestle Arts Base, visit the website www.trestle.org.uk.
My next piece is about delays from Royal Mail. Royal Mail has listed the areas in the UK suffering from delays due to COVID. The company said the delays are due to staff isolating and social distancing guidelines, meaning deliveries are taking longer. With areas around the UK still affected, Royal Mail released a service update for customers. The company said there are currently high volumes of mail being posted, which is having an impact on wait times. A statement issued yesterday said, "We're out delivering and collecting wherever it's safe and possible to do so today. We're sorry that some addresses may experience disruption as a result of snow and ice, particularly in parts of Scotland, Norfolk, Suffolk, Essex and Kent. Deliveries may also be disrupted in some areas due to resourcing issues in a number of our delivery offices." So the places listed are as follows: Croydon, Derby, Enfield, Grays DO, Harwich DO, South Croydon DO, St Albans, postcodes AL1 to AL5, Wootton Bassett DO. What Royal Mail said: "We're working hard to deliver as comprehensive a service as possible to all our customers during these challenging times. Every single parcel and letter is important to us. Despite our best efforts and significant investment in extra resource, some customers may experience slightly longer delivery timescales than our usual service standards. This is due to the exceptionally high volumes of mail posted during this further lockdown period, alongside necessary coronavirus-related measures we have put in place in local mail centres and delivery offices to keep our people and customers safe."
And now the list of deaths as announced in this week's Hearts Advertiser. Anne Lawson, 97. David Anthony Francis, 86. Gordon Arthur Hunt, 90. Jean Audrey Gould, 91. Patricia Clegg, 89. Peter Hubble, 70. And Thomas William Parker, 98. Now an item from the Talking Newspaper Federation archives. This fascinating piece is about the American president, Theodore Roosevelt, who lost an eye in a boxing accident.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello, this is Tanya with a biography of American president, Theodore Roosevelt. Written by Sarah Sherwin. As the world watches the first 100 days of the new American president in 2021, it's timely to remember the partially sighted US President Theodore, or Teddy, Roosevelt. Theodore Roosevelt was the 26th and youngest president of the United States of America, having assumed office at the age of 42, following the death of President McKinley. His life was one of both adventure and political ambition, and he was known for achieving significant changes within both national and foreign policy, and increasing his country's participation in international affairs. He's one of the presidents commemorated in the Mount Rushmore National Memorial. Theodore Roosevelt was born in October 1858 into a wealthy and influential family in New York of Dutch and English descent. He was the second of four children. As a child, he was described as being sickly with severe asthma as well as poor eyesight. he became determined to build his strength and develop a stronger physique through participation in sports such as boxing, which he described as, quote, a good condensed way of getting exercise, unquote. As well as boxing, he took part in several outdoor sports, including sailing and hiking, and bought a cattle ranch, enjoying the life of a cowboy. He boxed at Harvard and started boxing clubs when he was commissioner for the New York Police Department and continued to invite sparring partners to the White House after he became president in 1900. It was during one of these sparring matches at the White House that he ultimately lost the sight of his left eye when he was punched. Roosevelt was educated at home by tutors and went on to Harvard, graduating in 1880. After graduating, he began studying law at Columbia Law School, but became more interested in pursuing writing and politics as a career. He was elected as a Republican to the New York State Assembly in 1884, aged 23. However, he left politics and public life for 2 years, seeking refuge at his cattle ranch in Dakota, following the tragic deaths of his mother and wife in the same house on Valentine's Day in 1884. His wife died from Bright's disease and complications of childbirth. His baby daughter, Alice, survived. He remarried in 1886 and had 6 children, including his first daughter, Alice. After being unsuccessful in an attempt to become mayor of New York City, he resumed his career in public life when he was made commissioner of the New York Police Department in 1895. He brought with him a determination to tackle the corruption he identified within the police force. He also held the position of Assistant Secretary to the Navy and sought to increase the size and influence of the Navy. However, he resigned this post and lobbied for a declaration of war with Spain in 1898. He himself fought during the Spanish-American War with the 1st Volunteer Cavalry, also known as the Rough Riders, and was considered at the time to be a national hero, recognised for his leadership in the Battle of San Juan Hill in 1898, which determined the outcome of the war. The war marked the emergence of America as a world power. Following the war, Roosevelt became governor of New York in 1899 and then vice president of America in 1900. He became president a year later after President McKinley was assassinated. As president, Roosevelt sought to increase America's participation in world politics and was concerned about the effect of political corruption in America. He's known for his introduction of the so-called Square Deal domestic policies. This was a deal between business interests and the workforce. It was based upon 3 concepts, dubbed the 3 Cs. Conservation of natural resources, control of corporations, and consumer protection. A strong part of his political agenda was a commitment to the conservation of natural resources. He was the first president to promote conservation as a national agenda and set aside more federal land for national parks and reserves, 194 million acres, than the combined total of all his predecessors. His legacy clearly lives on, recognised by the Theodore Roosevelt National Park and Theodore Roosevelt Island. The National Conservation Commission was created following a conference of state leaders and scientists held by Roosevelt at the White House. Roosevelt was also concerned about the potential damage of monopolies on industries. This was described as his trust-busting policy. Competing firms had joined together to form large organisations that could dominate industries and sought to control corporations, including the railroads and the meat industry. Trust-busting sought to address these issues. Famously, he successfully intervened in the 1902 coal strike, achieving some improvement in working conditions and pay for miners. Another significant achievement, which Roosevelt is said to have identified as, quote, his most historically significant international achievement, unquote, was the construction of the Panama Canal, which was to have a major impact on promoting American military and commercial interests. Roosevelt was the first American to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1906 for his role in ending the Russo-Japanese War. He encouraged William Taft to stand for presidency in 1908, but he became frustrated by his politics once president. Roosevelt sought unsuccessfully to run for the 1912 Republican nomination as leader of the Bull Moose Party, which espoused progressive reforms. The effect of this was to split the Republican vote, and Woodrow Wilson was elected as a Democratic president. Over the next 7 years, Roosevelt's physical health deteriorated, although he did lead a 2-year expedition to the Amazon. He died in 1919. As well as his political legacy, Roosevelt was also a prolific writer and wrote 35 books, an autobiography, and 150,000 letters. His legacy in popular culture is to have given his name to the teddy bear. The story behind this is that Roosevelt was on a hunting trip and guides had arranged for him to shoot an old bear tethered to a tree. Roosevelt refused to do this, and the incident was immortalized in a New York cartoon. This gave a shopkeeper the idea of selling stuffed bears, and Roosevelt agreed to them being called teddy bears. There was, of course, another President Roosevelt later in the 20th century, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Often known as FDR, he was Theodore Roosevelt's fifth cousin once removed, and he married Eleanor Roosevelt, Theodore's niece. A Democrat, FDR was the 32nd president. Whilst Theodore Roosevelt was recognised as a progressive politician, there are increasingly elements of his presidency that are now identified as racist, with episodes like the Spanish-American War being the subject of contemporary debate.
TNF Soundings.
Some more news now.
Memories of gang shows past from audience and participants. And this article is accompanied by 3 photographs of the stage at the Auburn Arena. And on the stage are groups of young people in fabulous costumes, dancing, smiling, having fun, looking like they're having the time of their lives. Apart from the annual pantomime, perhaps the biggest event in the Auburn Arena's calendar is the annual St Albans Gang Show. With the pandemic having scuppered this year's show, we couldn't let the date when it usually starts pass without comment. So we have spoken to participants and audience members about their memories of past performances, in a bit to find out just what it is that makes it so special. Becky Alexandra said, "It's such a joy and so professionally produced every year. I loved the sunflowers in shades of giant revolving gold coin last year." Emma Payne said, "I still have some of my gang shows DVDs from when I was in it. That was between 2005 and 2008, and I loved every minute of it." St Albans resident and former Hearts reporter Frankie Berry took part in the St Albans Gang Show from 2005 and 6 to 2009 and 10. She said, "I have so many great memories of the gang show. It's hard to choose the best one. I'll never forget the opening item in my first show. We had rehearsed for months and months, but you can't prepare for that amazing feeling when that curtain rises. We all wore these amazing, vibrant, metallic pink jackets and danced to Staying Alive. I still know the routine and I still have the jacket, although I'm pretty sure I wouldn't fit into it now." Frankie said that Gang Show was a huge part of her teenage years, not only because of the rehearsals throughout autumn and winter, but because of the amazing people she met there, who I'm still friends with today. She said the experience really helped her in her career as a journalist, as it gave her the confidence needed to put herself out there and meet new people. She added, It also taught me what it means to make a commitment and to follow through with it. There are loads of rehearsals. And how to work as a team to be part of something bigger than myself. She said it also gave other opportunities, such as the chance to perform at the O2 Arena.
My final story is about the Gang Show and is entitled Gang Show Goes Virtual After COVID Cancellation. It's probably the most cheerful thing about February. Since its first time round back in 1980, thousands of young people have been involved in the annual St Albans Gang Show. But this year's performances have been cancelled due to the pandemic. Featuring young people aged 11 to 25 from the St Albans District Scouts and the Girl Guiding St Albans Division, the annual variety show has been entertaining audiences at the Alban Arena for over 40 years. The show is an evening full of singing, dancing, acting and comedy sketches performed by scouts and guides from all over the district. It's usually a sellout and is rehearsed over many months leading up to the week of the performances. We spoke to producer Hermione Drew to find out how the pandemic has affected the Gang Show community after the inevitable decision was made to cancel the show that should have run in the Auburn Arena in February. Hermione said, "This is of course heartbreaking, but we are also so fortunate that we had not started any planning or rehearsals, and so the disappointment was not as great as it was for many other gang shows around the UK who had to cancel their show at the last moment when they were due to perform in March or April 2020. She added that this last year has highlighted prominently how important the people involved, both cast and volunteers, are to each other. When you suddenly don't see the lifelong friends you have made or been able to be in a room with more than 100 smiling young people singing and dancing their hearts out, you realise how much those things mean. And that is what it's all about for the people taking part too. They always talk to the team about the friendships they make, the feeling that they can just be themselves at the gang show, and the confidence they gain in their talents," she said. "We remain a strong group of committed volunteers and cast who are waiting eagerly for a time when it is safe to do what we love again for the supportive audience we have in St Albans. Simple moments of togetherness really do keep you energised and help you feel connected and supported. The feeling of being able to achieve anything together is really powerful, and every year I feel so lucky to be part of this special team in St Albans. We are still achieving a lot behind the scenes online together, but I can't wait to feel that magic, all of us being in the same rehearsal space or the Auburn Arena again soon." Volunteers, cast and parents of cast members have kept in touch via Zoom as much as possible since lockdown began, so that everybody could be kept updated as decisions were made about this year's show. The decision to cancel Gang Show 2021 was made in August. The team running it discussed all their risks and reasons and considered feedback from other people involved. Hermione said, "The team were supportive of the decision to cancel. At that time, we were uncertain if we were being overcautious. With hindsight, it seems obvious we did the right thing cancelling, as we would have had no choice. The cast from previous shows have been learning dance routines to old Gang Show favourite songs and taking part in online quizzes and silly games. Anyone who wanted to be in the 2021 show will be able to audition next year. There will be two special broadcasts on Wednesday, February the 10th and Saturday, February the 13th at 7:30. Check the St Albans Gang Show website, www.stalbansgangshow.com, for updates." Hermione explained what to expect. "We plan to do a live stream of our 2020 show for people to enjoy again on what should have been our opening night for 2021. We have also been collecting votes on people's favourite sketches and numbers they have seen at St Albans Gang Show perform over the years. And we are piecing the recordings of these together with some extra surprises into a virtual screening on what should have been our final night performing at the Auburn Arena."
My next article is titled, "Classes and Online Groups Are a Movement for Good." Rennie Grove's physiotherapists have responded to extended periods of lockdown and the need to keep vulnerable patients safe by offering online movement groups. Specialist physiotherapist Ruth McGuinness, usually based at Grove House in St Albans, has transferred her specialist and tailored sessions online to ensure that patients get the support they need to keep as healthy and active as possible in the safety of their own homes. Prior to the pandemic, Movement, a weekly exercise and well-being class, took place at Grove House with group members performing circuits of exercises to build strength and mobility. When the class was no longer able to take place, Ruth knew that the support needed to continue. Many members of our group live alone and have never engaged formally with exercise, so we knew the class was important for their physical health, explained Ruth. But we also recognised that the opportunity at the end of the class to sit and have refreshments was vital peer support. Sharing their experiences with others in similar situations really helped them to realise they aren't alone. When the class stopped, we knew that finding a way to bring it to them at home would be a lifeline for them, physically and mentally. In addition to adapting the class so that patients could perform the circuits easily at home, Ruth and her physiotherapist, Christina Muldoon, have also been helping some group members to learn how to use video chat so they could take part. Winter weather combined with lockdown have meant that many in this group have scarcely left their homes. Ruth said, "Isolation can be really damaging to health overall, but we've seen that performing simple exercises alongside people who are also feeling lonely can make a huge difference. We've received wonderful feedback from the group. Most of them are thrilled to be able to get moving around, but the opportunity to spend time together makes all the difference. It brings excitement, laughter, and positivity to their day, and it's a great feeling to be a part of that." To find out more about the services Rennie Grove offers at Grove House, visit www.renniegrove.org. And there's also a picture of Ruth McGuinness doing some exercises.
Now, the radio listings read by John Cushing.
Now, for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, February 13th. The afternoon drama on Radio 4 is Life Class by Rachel Joyce. A young man bumps into Stella on the street and knocks her off her feet. When he says, "I didn't even see you," this hurts more than the bruises on her face, and Stella begins to question everything about her life. A treat for opera lovers on Radio 3 at 6:30 p.m. when you can hear Maria Callas in a historic performance of Donizetti's Lucia de Lammermoor, recorded in 1956 at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. It was the American diva's only Met radio broadcast. At 8 p.m. on Radio 4, a new series of Meeting Myself coming back. John Wilson returns with the programme that uses archive recordings to give public figures the chance to reflect on their careers. This week, Alistair Campbell, a former sports journalist who became Downing Street Director of Communications under Tony Blair, and more recently, a mental health campaigner. On to Sunday, February 14th, and Valentine's Day, of course. In Desert Island Discs at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, Malala Yousafzai, women's education activist and Nobel Peace Prize winner, talks to Lauren Laverne about her life and selects 8 favourite recordings. Her story and inspiring work make her a great guest for the programme. On Radio 3 at 12 noon, Michael Barclay returns with Private Passions and welcomes Tim Harford, economist and presenter of Radio 4's More or Less. His mission is to show how good statistics can improve our lives. His music choices include Janacek, Britten, Philip Glass, Arvo Part, and Brian Eno. The afternoon drama on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. is Hardy's Women, Tess of the D'Urbervilles. This is the first in a season of plays taking a fresh look at Thomas Hardy's novels through the eyes of their female protagonists. Tess is the ultimate portrayal of a woman more sinned against than sinning. Hankies may be required, I'm told, particularly at the end. And The Seven Ages of Love is the title of Words of Music at 5:30 on Radio 3. As I mentioned, it is Valentine's Day. Samuel West and Hattie Morahan present poems and prose on love from young to old, including poetry by Shakespeare, John Donne, Elizabeth Jennings and Sarah Maguire. On to the programmes then that run each day at the same time, Monday to Friday, so every day of the weekday at the same time, same radio station. 9:45, Radio 4, Book of the Week, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster by Bill Gates. The philanthropist sets out a wide-ranging plan for how the world can get to zero greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. It's repeated each night at 12:30. 10:45 a.m., also on Radio 4, The 15-minute drama, This week is World of Curls by Yolanda Mercy. And it's about stylists and customers of a South London hairdressers for black women. Again, repeated every night, Monday to Friday, 7:45 p.m. Radio 3, at midday, Composer of the Week, continues its series about one Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart. This week, Donald MacLeod examines connecting points between the characters Mozart created for the stage and the composer's own experiences in life, beginning with the pivotal roles played by servants in his operas. Excerpts from The Marriage of Figaro, Cosi Van Tutti, Don Giovanni. Back to Radio 4 at 1:45, Monday to Friday, so all this week, in the weekday, is a new series called Life Chances. Successful journalist Akhtar Ahmed asks why the lives of former classmates from his school, Acton High in West London, went down such different paths, and he explores issues about multiculturalism, class divide, integration and segregation in modern Britain. 8 p.m. every night is the Classic FM concert with John Suchet, and he presents a week of programmes devoted to the top 300 from the Classic FM Hall of Fame, as voted for by listeners last year. Programme features music by Walton, Mozart, John Williams, Rachmaninoff and Sibelius. And at 10:45 on Radio 3, comedian and author Vic Groskop presents the essay Forgotten Feminist Futures. Let's go back then to Monday, February 15th, and start the week at 9 a.m. on Radio 4. Andrew Marr and guests discuss the blurring of the distinctions between online and real life. A shortened repeat is at 9:30 p.m. For those in need of a bit of old-fashioned comedy, how about Steptoe and Son from 1967? It's on Radio 4 Extra throughout the day, 8 a.m, 12 noon, 7 p.m. 2:15 on Radio 4, Faith, Hope and Glory, a series of intimate dramas about post-war Britain told through the lives of three women. It continues with Clement and Gloria, the story of a celibate couple who find a lost baby, decide to keep her and call her Joy. Final two stories can be heard, same time, 2:15, Radio 4, Tuesday and Wednesday this week. Finally for Monday, blues-inspired music, The Blues Show, Keris Matthews, Radio 2, 9 p.m. Tuesday, February 16th, and more vintage comedy on Radio 4 Extra with The Goon Show. 8 a.m. if you fancy an early laugh, 12 noon or 7 p.m. In England's Level Best at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, Sebastian Payne investigates Boris Johnson's pledges to tackle regional inequality, speaking to business owners and residents from across the North and the Midlands, as well as politicians and policymakers. Comedian Josie Long returns with a new series of Shortcuts at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. Short documentaries about acts of love, from carers during the AIDS epidemic to poet Nikita Gill's look at Almost Love, which ended in its beginning. Radio 3 in concert, 7:30 p.m, recorded June 2019, the East Nuke Festival in Fife, and features music by Dvorak, Schubert and Brahms. It's Tuesday. It's 8:40 p.m, it's Radio 4, it's In Touch with Peter White. Wednesday, February 17th, a new series, Wilf Self Takes the Waters, 9 a.m, Radio 4. In the first programme, The Ultimate Refreshment, Wilf Self investigates why Perrier Water took the world by storm and asks Nestlé, the brand's current owners, what they're doing to address concerns about its environmental impact. Opera on 3 over the next 4 evenings, and Radio 3 visits Wagner's Ring Cycle in performances recorded in 2018 at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, conducted by Antonio Pappano. In Das Rheingold at 7 p.m, Wagner lays out the theme of love versus power. And the folk show, with traditional and contemporary folk and acoustic music with Mark Radcliffe, is on Radio 2 at 9 p.m. Thursday, February 18th, 11:30 a.m. on Radio 4, John Keats' Life and Afterlife. Sasha Dugdale presents a profile of the great English romantic poet, shedding new light on his life as a doctor and a writer. First of two programmes, she focuses on Keats' final productive year, 1819, in which he wrote some of the greatest odes in the English language, including Ode to a Nightingale and to Autumn. The afternoon drama at 2:15 on Radio 4 is The Elder Son, a two-part adaptation of a classic 1969 Russian play by Alexander Vampilov about two tricksters who need shelter for the night after missing the last train home. They concoct an elaborate lie from which they can find it hard to extricate themselves. It concludes on Friday. Still on Radio 4, a new series of Between Ourselves with Marianne Keyes begins at 6:30 p.m. The author reads sections from her non-fiction writing while in conversation with her friend, the actor Tara Flynn. This week's theme is adventure. Lastly, we come to Friday, February 19th, another new series on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. In Britain's Fascist Thread, historian Camilla Schofield explores a century of British fascism from the formation of the British Fascisti in 1923, arguing that it's a central and ongoing part of the British story. A warning from history not to take our precious democracy for granted. On Radio 4 Extra at 2 p.m, The Map That Made Manhattan, first broadcast in 2014 and filled with the sounds of atmosphere of New York and some of its residents, the programme traces the evolution and impact of the Manhattan grid. It's created in 1811, a utopian vision to make all points equal. Opera on 3 at 5 p.m. is Siegfried, the third instalment of Wagner's Ring Cycle. And at 11:30 on Radio 4 to round up the week, Between the Years presents the Rising Sea Symphony, an evocation of the causes and consequences of rising, warming oceans in four movements, with the dramatic effects of climate change evoked in words, sounds, and a new musical work by composer Kieran Brunt. May, as ever, I wish you a peaceful, safe, and enjoyable week of radio listening.
Finally, an item I always use on the primary edition of the Talking Newspaper. Let's have a look at events and birthdates in the past that happened in this upcoming week. On the 14th of February in 1349, 900 Jews were burned alive in Strasbourg and others banned from the city after being blamed for the spread of the Black Death. In 1929, what became known as the St. Valentine's Day Massacre occurred in Chicago. On the 14th of February in 1984, ice dancers Jane Torval and Christopher Dean won gold at the Sarajevo Winter Olympics. And in 1989, the Supreme Leader of Iran issued a fatwa calling for the death of author Salman Rushdie. On the 15th of February, 1852, Great Ormond Street Hospital for Sick Children admitted its first patient. And on that date in 1971, pounds, shillings and pence were abandoned by Great Britain as it took up decimal currency. On the 15th of February in 2019, Donald Trump declared a national emergency to divert funds to build the border wall with Mexico. In 1923, on the 16th of February, Howard Carter opened the inner burial chamber of the Egyptian pharaoh Tutankhamun, finding his sarcophagus. And in 1959, Fidel Castro became the Prime Minister of Cuba on the 16th of February. On the 17th of February in 1972, British Parliament voted to join the European Common Market. In 2003, the London Congestion Charge began. And on the 17th of February in 2006, a massive mudslide in the Philippines resulted in over 1,000 deaths. On the 18th of February in 1678, John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress was published. In 1901, H. Cecil Booth patented a dust-removing suction cleaner. On the 18th of February in 1966, the casket used to carry the body of J.F. Kennedy from Dallas to his internment was not used for his burial, but, on the request of the Kennedy family, was dropped from an aeroplane over the Atlantic Ocean to prevent it coming into the hands of people who wished to put it on display. In 2014, on the 18th of February, the Ukrainian Revolution began with riots in Kiev, culminating 5 days later with the removal of President Yanukovych. On the 19th of February in 1914, when the US Postal Service began parcel deliveries, some ingenious parents realized that it was cheaper to post their children rather than pay fares. On this day, 5-year-old Charlotte Pierstoff was posted to her grandparents 73 miles away, the stamps stuck to her coat. She was accompanied by a post official and arrived safely. And on the 20th of February in 1975, a feud began between the official Irish Republican Army and the Irish National Liberation Army, resulting in a number of assassinations. In 1962, John Glenn became the first American to orbit the Earth. Here are some well-known people whose birthdates fall this week. On the 14th of February in 1951, Kevin Keegan, former football player and manager, was born. He played for several clubs, including Newcastle United, Southampton and Liverpool. In 1874, Sir Ernest Henry Shackleton was born. The Anglo-Irish Antarctic explorer led three British expeditions to the Antarctic. He was one of the principal figures of the period known as the Heroic Age of Antarctic Exploration. On the 16th of February in 1971, Amanda Holden, English actress and media personality, was born. Amanda currently co-hosts Heart Radio's breakfast show alongside Jamie Theakston. On the 17th of February in 1991, Ed Sheeran was born. The singer, songwriter and musician likes to name his guitars, his favourites being Lloyd, Felix, Cyril and Nigel. On the 18th of February in 1934, Spanish fashion designer Francesco Rabaneda Cuervo, more commonly known under the pseudonym of Paco Rabanne, was born. And on the 19th of February in 1940, William Smokey Robinson Jr., the American singer, songwriter, record producer, and former record executive, was born. Robinson was the founder and frontman of the Motown vocal group The Miracles, for which he was also chief songwriter and producer. And finally, on the 20th of February in 1966, Cindy Crawford, the American model, actress, and businesswoman, was born. During the 1980s and 1990s, Crawford was among the most popular supermodels and a ubiquitous presence on magazine covers, runways, and fashion campaigns. And that finishes up this week's edition of Saturn. My thanks to Kalpana, Peter, Alison, and Claire for reading the news, to Angela for providing the radio listings, and John who read them. Thanks also to TNF Soundings, and Wendy, Hazel and Joan for the week in history and famous birth dates. Let me take this opportunity of wishing you a safe and vaccinated February. Please remember to return your USB stick and wallet after use, and please stay well and safe at home. Goodbye.